Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your major league teenage girlfriend of music news and information. I'm your host, Joe Coscarelli. And as far as I can see, I just need privacy. Plus a whole lot of treat about this modesty. I just need space to do me, get a world what they're trying to see. A Stella Maxwell right beside of me. A Ferrari, I'm buying three. A closet of Saint Laurent, get what I want when I want, cause this hunger is driving me, yeah. You just heard G-Eazy, the West Coast's own G-Eazy. Me, Myself, and I featuring Bebe Rexha.
Yes, we did. We definitely did do that.
We're here with John Caramonica, pop music critic at the New York Times.
One thing I think we just got to establish right off rip is we don't take L's, we just make M's.
That's true.
That is true. Just if you know one thing about us.
John, you have a piece this weekend, Sunday Arts and Leisure section, about white rap.
What's the title of that piece?
The headline says, White Rappers, Clear of a Black Planet.
Shouts to the copy desk on that one.
A beautiful
play on words. I wish I could actually take credit for that headline, but that's
it's online now if you want to get at it early.
Okay, so I've been thinking, look, G-Eazy has been popular for quite some time.
So is G-Eazy the hottest rapper in the game? Asterisk, white edition? Tell me about this alternate universe. Make me a double XL cover of the white rap universe right now. I know Lil Dicky's on the real one, but let's erase
so
that.
So you have Mike Studd, you have Lil Dicky, you have, you know, Version, you have Post Malone, mm-hmm. and certainly the center of that is G-Eazy. Like if the layout of the cover, the guy in the center.
The hottest rapper in the game.
White edition. And G-Eazy is relevant for a couple of reasons right now. I mean, first of all, he has actually been making records for quite some time. It's not a total out of nowhere.
He didn't come out of nowhere.
Not total out of nowhere. I wrote about him.
He built.
He did. I mean, you know, we can jest about
where
it.
It's
but
due. Yeah.
I mean, you know, what, 2014 or 2013, you know, he's been making songs and getting attention for quite some time. The thing that really made me want to write about G-Eazy in this moment was two things. One, he started getting play on Hot 97 quite a bit with this song that we just heard, Me, Myself, and I. And all I can think about when I heard this song was I was like, oh, this is like how I would imagine, like, if you lived in another country and you were trying to make a quote-unquote rap song, like you'd have a white rapper and a white singer doing a rap and a hook. And that's what this is. It's just here in America. And Hot 97 is sort of having its persistent identity crisis about, like, Are we a pop station? Yeah,
are we a rhythm station?
Right. And so it kind of fits in.
You get some chain smokers that on there every once in a while.
RIP.
Young Ma into Young MA, into the chain smokers.
All right, don't add us. First of all, don't add us. But RIP. I thought about why a record like that was having so much success
this moment that opened the doors to a white rapper with a white singer on the hook.
Well, there's definitely
being
a
played on a rap station.
Well, we'll get to that. But the second thing that really struck me was when I saw the tour announcement for the Endless Summer Tour, which is a co-headline between G-Eazy and Logic.
Who's Logic? Tell the people who Logic is. Logic is Kevin Durant's favorite rapper. I feel like we should get that out of the way first.
Kevin Durant plays for the Golden State Warriors.
He will. We'll see.
Plays the Golden State Warriors. Logic is a rapper who is on Def Jam, strangely enough.
Good label.
Logic is the child of a white mother and a black father. And his show really reminded me of, it was almost Woody Allen-ish in a strange way. Like he's sort of nebbishy. He's like a nebbishy dude who is literally making a beat live on stage and telling everybody to be really positive. And he's a good technical rapper, but his fans feel like they skew very young and like reasonably white.
He's about good vibes, right?
He is about following your dreams. But he's about bars too. Right, like bars. Never forget bars. Logic is about bars more than G-Eazy is about bars, right. Just for what it's worth.
Right.
But the thing that was most striking about this tour is these rappers are the headliners or the co-headliners. And the opening acts are actual rappers with real hits, Yo Gotti and YG. And I was very struck. I was like, oh, what a weird moment that we've arrived at, that a guy like G-Eazy, who basically has half a mainstream hit,
right,
and Logic, who actually has no mainstream hits but
zero,
a really rabid internet fan base,
yes,
can headline the Barclays Center, and YG and Yo Gotti play at 7:30.
And this is a weird, I mean, this is a weird dinner party, right? G-Eazy,
it's
Logic.
It's extremely weird, you know,
Gotti,
unless you believe that bars equate unite us all.
So
that, you
so
that.
Technical rapping is the only thing that unites these guys?
Except for, I wouldn't say that. I think it's that technical rapping gets Logic to the party,
right.
And like flexing gets G-Eazy to the party.
Right.
You look at that, and that really stressed me out, frankly. I was like, oh, this is actually like Macklemore was the moment,
uh-huh.
But Macklemore was the breakthrough,
uh-huh.
But this is actually the moment where this is sort of normalized. Because everybody.
Where is Macklemore, by the way?
Yo, I don't want to cite Wikipedia, but I definitely looked at the Wikipedia numbers on this unruly rest I made the other day, and it was like 60,000? Is that a real?
It was a tough cycle for Macklemore.
And it was. Macklemore was in a very unusual position of having to kind of be like, I made the records that I wanted to make, but also like black artists respect me. And he sort of made a record that kind of was in between those two spaces, and it turned out that no one cared.
Meanwhile, Iggy Azalea, her album is question mark.
Yes.
So we had this moment of.
But Iggy Azalea has no anxiety.
Right.
That's like Macklemore let his.
Read her Twitter feed and tell me she has no anxiety.
It's not that kind of anxiety. I actually think that Iggy will come back and do better numbers than Macklemore because Macklemore made records that were sort of driven by his need to kind of like placate his own anxiety.
But so we had this mini moment of Macklemore, Iggy Azalea.
Pop white rap breakthrough.
Pop white rap breakthrough a couple years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Did that lead into G-Eazy? Did that open the door for G-Eazy?
I think what it did is it made it plain, from a radio perspective, that pop radio could play white rap with basically no blowback, and it would be widely accepted, and then artists who came through that tunnel could actually have a path.
Right.
That's something that was relatively new, because outside of Eminem and obviously Vanilla Ice and Beastie Boys, but like you didn't really have a sustained movement. You always had these kind of exceptional artists,
right.
Artists who are like one of ones.
So talk to me about what makes these guys different, because G-Eazy sort of walks the line, right? He came up a little bit through the Bay Area
sort of like late period hyphy and whatnot.
Right.
This is sort of what's been happening. And this has actually been happening, I would venture to say, over the last 4 or 5 years, not just post-Macklemore. Say you're a touring agent. Say you work for a touring company,
mm-hmm.
And you put acts on the road. And you see people like Cam Meekins, Sammy Adams, Mike Studd. People who are
the children of Mac Miller. Mac Miller 1.0.
1.0, but
Asher
also,
Roth.
Yes, I would say children of the dumb version of Asher Roth. Because even Mike Studd's first song is basically just an Asher Roth
yes.
jack.
I love college, I think he says.
Right, yes, and it's like the song is called college. It's yes. called, you know, whatever it's called. All of these kids start to make records, right? And they start to get internet attention, whether that's SoundCloud or MySpace or whatever it was in their particular moment. And I think touring agents got on that scene much faster than rap record labels.
And this
and I think
scene
that's because
exists only strictly in parallel to the rap internet. It's not the same rap internet of...
No. I mean, I think that there are overlaps, but I think it's basically an isolated, or it was an isolated movement, relatively.
With college
but,
kids, mainly.
Yes, but it had a good deal of attention. And I think if you have a touring base or a natural appeal to college students, you know, there are touring agents whose entire job is to book you at spring flings or, you know, frat shows or whatnot. So this generation of rappers actually started getting touring money. They were getting touring money before they were getting label interest. And I think that's because I think a touring agent is frankly a lot more mercenary than a record label.
Right.
If you work at Def Jam A&R, Interscope A&R, you're agonizing.
You have
the
legacy.
Yeah,
yeah
you got
to worry.
Are you the label that signed Mike Studd and ruined Def Jam? Like, I don't know. Like, maybe you are. Or maybe Mike Studd saves Def Jam.
Right.
You don't know. But I think if you work as an A&R at a label, you have a much more lengthy and obstacle-filled process towards shifting your label's attention to something like this than if you work as a touring agent.
And the money is in touring, right? We're in the post-CD era.
Yeah, the money is always going to be in touring. And so if you work at a touring and you just be like, okay, well, let's just put this kid on the road. I get my 10% or 5% or whatever it is, and that kid's working. What ended up happening is a few of those artists, Mike Studd being one of them, G-Eazy, not exactly like that, but sort of parallel, started getting legitimate fan bases touring, not hip-hop clubs. It's not like they're doing, your Southern strip club and nightclub circuit. You know, they're doing venues that, like, indie rock bands
right.
play in.
Small rock venues or college campuses.
Right. And so all of a sudden they have real fan bases. And that's how you end up with G-Eazy and, by extension, Logic headlining the Barclays.
Right.
And so that really struck me. And it struck me also that YG and Yo Gotti would happily sign on to this and just kind of be like, well, what the hell? Like, we'll just go for the ride. So that's what's been happening over the last 4 or 5 years. I think the Macklemore moment happened sort of not in concert with that, but the breakthrough that Macklemore had at radio then became important for someone like G-Eazy, who kind of had that instinct to be a radio rapper. I'm not sure that, say, Mike Studd or Lil Dicky, for example, are really going to be radio rappers, but for someone like G-Eazy who walks that line, someone like Macklemore breaking through makes it easier for him to break through.
What does G-Eazy sound like? Tell the people what G-Eazy sounds like.
These are loaded questions. G-Eazy is he's a swag rapper. You know what I mean? Like, he's flexing. Like, that's his thing.
He's smooth.
Yeah, he's
the hair.
It's
the
important.
Jackets.
Well, that's not what he sounds like.
No,
Joe.
But I'm saying, but his music sounds like
yes.
he looks.
It's important when you think about G-Eazy that you think about Elvis, and not because G-Eazy is the Elvis of rap, because he's not. Frankly, he's not that good or that interesting, but G-Eazy comes out in 2011 or 2012 with a song that kind of covers a Dion DiMucci song,
right.
Runaround Sue.
Sure.
But he turns it – it's basically like a thought anthem. You know, like that's what it turns into. And so on the one hand, G-Eazy is sort of very, very contrivedly making a crossover record that will be broadly appealing. On the other hand, he's like a pretty foul-mouthed – greasy kind of rapper. I wouldn't say he's the smoothest in terms of flow,
right.
but in terms of subject matter, and you listen to the whole of the new album, it's like he's not like a Lil Dicky who's like making white sub or like a Macklemore making white subject matter
right.
in a rap song. He's just a rapper
he's just
who
rap
just happens
songs.
To be white.
Right.
Is he the best rapper? No. He's an okay rapper. B minus rapper? He's okay.
Do white rappers get graded on a curve?
I don't. Do you?
But his skill level is maybe can be lower.
Well, I think what you could say is the average fan who is coming to the G-Eazy show did not come through the gauntlet of Nas, Mobb Deep, even E-40 or whatever. Like right. even his icons.
Right.
Like, you know, I think I was at that show and it was just a lot of young teenage white girls.
Right.
And I'm not saying that they're not all obsessed with bars, because maybe they are obsessed with bars. But I think that fan base is not about bars.
Sure.
Not that bars are the only metric. Shouts to Lil B. Shouts to Soulja Boy. You know what I mean? Like, it's not – that's not the only
shouts
thing.
Shouts to Post Malone.
Shouts.
Should we talk about Post Malone? Where does he fit into this universe?
So this has been tough because – Post Malone is really right on the edge of even being in this piece at all, because you can really make the case that he's not a rapper. And I think Post Malone would like to make that case
right.
himself, if only just to avoid being in pieces like this and having conversations like the one he recently had in public with the editor of XXL. Post Malone is a guy who feels maybe a little opportunistic.
He took the signifiers of rap, if not the hashtag
bars. He's got the teeth. He's got the cosign. You know, it's like he's partying with the right people. He's presenting in the right way. But Post Malone is someone who I think has a genuinely interesting hybrid of a sound. Like the idea that he is doing Bob Dylan covers 2 years ago on the internet, but then sort of was like, I'm going to take that aesthetic approach and kind of apply it to rap. Like,
the man loves Sublime.
Who doesn't, really?
And we need more Sublime influence.
Talk about bars. Like all bars.
Bradley, rest yeah. in peace.
But Post Malone to me is someone who I think he's aware of the aesthetics, and I think he's maybe weirdly advanced aesthetically, but he's not aware of the politics. He's almost riffraffy in a way. I didn't mention riffraff in this piece.
You did not.
There was a long list of people I didn't mention in this piece, but like there's something.
His ghost is hovering over
yeah,
this piece.
Yeah, there is. And there's something riffraffy about Post Malone, because like Post Malone feels like a weird invented character.
Yes.
You know, he feels like something you'd see in Spring Breakers or something.
Right.
Post Malone is a guy who I think isn't astute enough to have the race conversation, even though he's living the race conversation every single day.
He was asked on the radio what he was doing for Black Lives Matter. He did not have an answer.
Didn't. Just a thing for all you journalists out there, always ask what's being done for Black Lives Matter. you'll get a good answer.
What is G-Eazy doing for Black Lives Matter?
He's on FDT, the anti-Donald Trump YG anthem that is definitely a great song that's not getting nearly enough attention. And he's on a version of it with Macklemore.
Is it going to get more attention now that it has two white rappers on it?
I wish the answer to that were yes, but I think the answer is actually no, because it's been out for quite some time and it still hasn't bubbled above the surface.
Fair enough. But they performed it at this show, at the G-Eazy
did, not Macklemore. Right. That would have been too much.
YG too came much up during too much G-Eazy set.
Came back out during, yes, like G-Eazy brought YG out to do that record. And they, you know, they flashed the words real big on the screen behind them. You know, G-Eazy's taking it seriously. G-Eazy's tough because a lot of this piece is about, we didn't really talk about the kind of big theme of the piece, but accountability has always been a hallmark of white presence in hip hop, whether it's someone put me on, a black mentor put me on.
Eminem.
Or I am so serious about this music that I'm just so knowledgeable that my music is so clearly an extension of the black history.
And
that
you
came
mentioned
before
Action
me.
Bronson.
Action Bronson, Droog.
These sort of students, they studied, they put in the work.
And they insert themselves into the historical legacy by displaying fealty, being true to the sort of value set that they inherited from an earlier generation, but not necessarily innovating on top of that. So you have these two well-established paths towards quote-unquote acceptance. Now, obviously, there's plenty of people who don't accept all of those people. But broadly speaking, those are the two doors white rappers have walked in.
Right.
It's interesting because I think Macklemore would tell you that he did that, and he probably did. But unfortunately, the legacy of Macklemore is not going to be that. The legacy of Macklemore is going to be his success and how he was received. And I think how he was received actually made it very plain to those of us who pay attention that there's an entire audience out there for white rappers who are waiting to be activated, who are not fans necessarily of other rap.
And it's not a coincidence that Macklemore's breakthrough hit, Thrift Shop, was a sort of satirical take on hip-hop opulence.
I mean, this is sort of the problem, ultimately. It's like, I think Macklemore is like a reasonably politically aware guy. I mean, talked to him earlier this year. I know he's attuned to the inherent contradictions.
Now more than ever.
Of course. But Thrift Shop is definitely a joke about rap music. And I don't think Macklemore in his heart wanted to get famous off of a joke about rap music. But nevertheless, that's what happened.
Lil Dicky, on the other hand?
No, Lil Dicky definitely wants to be famous. And like joking about rap music is his actual, it's his bailiwick. You know what I mean?
Talk a little bit about how Lil Dicky fits in.
Well, let's talk about accountability, sure. Broadly speaking. Because what's happening now is all these things where people were held to task about their participation in the genre, now they're not being held to task. Like, you could literally be a white rapper with white fans, white industry. Like, you're not on a mainstream, you're not on a rap label.
Covered by white media.
Yeah. And you could basically bypass it. You can be in your own private space. Actually, we should probably talk about Mike Studd right now. Because
yeah, you mentioned Mike Studd a few times. Not everyone knows who Mike Studd is. Not everyone gets the Esquire Network.
No. Should we listen to a little Mike Studd?
Let's listen to some Mike Studd.
Which jam you want to get into?
Let's listen to These Days.
All right. Let's get into These Days. You know the deal, you know what's up. You ain't the only one. You knew that. Yeah. Everything I see up in my head just comes to life. Got my favorite girl waking up in my bed. It's only right. Bad shit, my only type. Independent too. Get it, boo. Just promise me you won't let all the they say into you, you a 10. I'm not perfect, but for you, I do pretend. I've been working 2 to 10. That's AM. Ain't nobody quite like him. Put in a time like him. I've been grinding. So that's Mike Studd, who
has a familiar sound.
Yeah. That's who does that remind you?
I caught a little. Is it a little Aubrey?
A little
Aubrey in there?
Well, just a touch of Drizzy. I think the Drake thing is something we got to come back to. But to talk about Mike Studd. So Mike Studd is one of these guys who's kind of a 1.0 post Asher Roth, basically a frat rapper. A thing that really jumped out at me about Mike Studd this year is not that he had a record that went to number one on the iTunes hip hop charts.
Which he did.
Right. Although that's just like a weird game. It came out in January.
Yes.
You and me could have had a record that went to number one on iTunes.
Next January.
Yeah. Watch out. But he had a reality show. It's called This Is Mike Studd. It's on the Esquire Network, which is apparently a TV network. Mm-hmm. I get it. Mm-hmm. Shouts to my Verizon Fios.
It's also online. You can stream it.
I know you did.
I streamed all 8 episodes. Not ashamed.
So Mike Studd is ostensibly popular enough to host, to have a reality show of his own.
He went on a nationwide tour.
Yeah, a lot of people go on nationwide tours.
He went on a seemingly successful tour.
Wouldn't you rather see a reality show of Plies on tour, of Lil Boosie on tour? Like, I would much rather see that reality show. Anyway, point being, Mike Studd is popular enough to have sold the idea of having a television show. And what you see is that Mike Studd is basically creating a frat rager in all these cities that he goes to. That's his
set,
brand.
His set on stage is a bar.
Yes,
literally,
his set is a bar.
Set up a bar on stage.
Yeah, and they're downing beers and they're downing bottles of vodka and they're throwing up.
All of his friends are just hanging out at the bar.
And it's girls gone wild out in the audience. There's a guy with the camera and all he's doing is inducing women to flash their chests.
And they do.
They do, which is on television if you care to see it. That's a real thing that's happening. But the most telling moment of this entire show to me, there's a thing, I think it's in the 4th episode, and they're on tour, but they're doing a show that's not a Mike Studd show. Like, this is literally what Mike Studd says. He's like, he's telling his mom, he's like, it's not a Mike Studd show. Like, sort of apologetic. And what it is just a festival that someone booked him for, and Currency is the headliner. And
where is it, John?
It's in Orlando.
Orlando, Florida.
Close to
born
your
and bred.
Yes.
Your
heart was born there. So it's in Orlando. You look at the crowd. It's kind of a small crowd. And it's not that the crowd isn't
white.
Yeah, it's like I'd
pretty
say
white.
Pretty white. But all the other acts on the bill, except for one of the openers that's on the Mike Studd tour, are black. You know, 2-9 is on the bill. I mean, I found the flyer from the actual thing online, like 2-9.
Currency, Mikey Rocks.
Left Brain and Mike G from Odd Future, a bunch of local guys.
And this is the first time you pretty much see black rappers even referenced in the show.
It's very, very striking how you basically get through all 8 episodes, and apart from this one scene, it's like you would actually think that all rap was like this. Like, if you didn't know better, you would just be like, oh, this is like a totally normal thing. Like, all rap must be like this. When Mike Studd goes out on stage, he looks kind of reticent. He's like, kind of like, does his rappy thing, and he doesn't. There's no drinking on stage. Some of that, I think, maybe was the venue didn't allow it.
The
but,
fans don't know the words.
Right.
It's not the same vibe.
It's an awkward moment, and it's almost as if he knows that, like, his thing, his shtick,
it's separate,
and it wouldn't be welcome, and almost, like, weirdly needs to protect. Like, he's created this very safe white space where he can express this, basically, these white ideas.
I think we call it America.
Yeah, sure. But, you know, most of the rest of rap music is not that.
Right.
And this is the one moment in the reality show where I feel like there's an actual injection of reality where his world overlaps or intersects with the rest of the rap world, and he looks reluctant.
And his manager says this is a weird
show. He's like, it's a weird show for us, which also just like a shockingly unself-aware thing. Like, I just feel like if you're Mike Studd and you're a white rapper with a reality show, you go on TV and just be like, hey, yeah, this is, you know, my thing is like a little bit left field. Maybe even take the argument of like it's underground or it's counterculture or whatever it is. That's an option.
So that's one of the differences now, is that there used to be some shame in being a white rapper. You were constantly having to apologize or prove your bona fides.
Yeah, you had to argue. You had to argue on your own behalf. And there's literally nothing in the Mike Studd universe or in the universe in which he exists that's apologetic or self-aware.
We should say that, as far as we know, he's unsigned.
Unsigned, does not appear to be signed. Yes, does not appear to be signed. Does not appear to be on a big management company.
Doesn't get radio play, really.
No, and I think what's striking is, you know, the big star, like the guest appearances in this show are professional athletes, which is a whole separate universe. OVO Ryan, which sort of we can get to the Drake thing. So OVO Ryan is Drake's cousin. 2 management representatives, Lenny S., who works for Roc Nation, and Kevin Lyles, who has been a figure in the hip-hop industry for decades. That's the closest you get to kind of like conventional rap.
And as you say, the only rapper I think that they mention in the show is Drake.
Yes. Drake looms really heavily over, I think, both G-Eazy and Mike Studd.
So Mike Studd, who was a baseball player in college,
yes,
played at Duke,
was a
got
relief
hurt,
pitcher, All-American.
Turned into a joke rapper, mm-hmm, and then sort of decided to level up and be- become a real musician.
In the same way that those touring agents basically discovered, you know, that a guy like him could sell out college campuses and whatnot, I think the process was as much discovery for him, because the first couple songs that he put online, I don't get the sense he was trying to rap. He was just recovering from an injury.
Right.
And then all of a sudden it's like, oh, well, this is – I can do this.
And so when the Asher Roth frat rap thing sort of burned out or hit its ceiling, he found a new sound.
Yeah, it's really striking, because These Days comes out kind of in the middle of If You're Reading This, It's Too Late and Views. It's in the middle of those two things. And it almost sounds like an average of those ideas. Not that he could have heard Views before, but you sort of sense – you know what
we know what Drake sounds
you know what
like.
Album Drake sounds like. Like, you know, if we believe in the idea of mixtape Drake versus album Drake, like, we know what album Drake sounds like. So it sounds like kind of the average of those two things. And, you know, Mike Studd is like an okay rapper, and his producers, who are two white guys, if you believe what's on the TV show, they do an okay job of kind of like doing Drake simulacra. Like, they're fine at it, but it all very much, in the same way that the G-Eazy BB Rexa record feels like a simulation of a regular rap radio hit, the Mike Studd stuff feels like a 5x Xerox simulation of Drake. And I
so
think
when
Drake's,
is Mike Studd's dance hall record coming?
Yo.
I'm just saying.
You called it. It's your fault, basically, if that happens. That's on you. The fact that Mike Studd is doing Drake records, I mean, talks about, number one, Mike Studd maybe not having a total original vision for himself. But also, it really, really speaks to how heavily Drake hovers, not just over mainstream hip-hop, but over kind of like all of our worlds. And he is a very accessible and relatable idea. Mike Studd is not trying to make YG records. Mike Studd is not trying to make Yo Gotti records. He's not trying to make Lil Wayne records. He's making Drake records.
So Drake with
G-Eazy, on the other hand, weirdly, there's a record on the G-Eazy on the album that's a ripoff of Future's Commas, which is nuts. It like has the same sample or a ripoff of the same sample. He actually says F up some comma. Like, it's
that
it's
exists.
Super weird. Gerald, what are you doing?
To go back to Drake for a second. Drake comes out, child actor, white mother, half Jewish, middle class, started from the bottom. We don't, you know.
Yeah, sure.
He's from a different place. Did his success make it acceptable to be a middle class rapper, basically? You know, Kanye before him.
Yes, I mean,
there's been a lineage of this.
I think you got to trace it back to Kanye, number one. But I do think that Drake's ubiquity kind of in the internet era, because Kanye is like a little bit not that the internet didn't exist, but his success predates internet success.
Yes.
Drake's success very much dovetails with like internet ubiquity.
King of streaming.
Yeah, so we've heard. And so because of that, I think if you're a young rapper, like, there's a story that I know where basically someone said to someone who works with a rapper who we have talked about already said to someone who I know who is a friend of mine, basically like, I don't understand why anyone wouldn't like Drake, because that's literally the entirety of their world, like Drake's success and Drake's value system and Drake's aesthetic choices. So if you are Mike Studd trying to be like
that,
and you're trying to be like a little bit legitimate, that's your framework, because you couldn't possibly make a little
Wayne
record.
It's within reach.
Yeah, you couldn't make a Future record. You couldn't make a YG record, but you can maybe make a Drake record. And so if you're going to try something, that's probably going to be the thing you're going to try.
Can Mike Studd reverse crossover? Be accepted by a rap audience?
Look, obviously, the thing we know now is that there is not one rap audience. And I think that's the real takeaway of this piece, should be that there are audiences that consider themselves rap audiences that are not the audiences that I grew up on or that you grew up on. Like, this is – the genre is cleaving into many, many pieces right now.
If we took a Mike Studd fan's iPhone, what else is on it?
I think Drake is on it. Maybe 21 Pilots. Maybe Florida Georgia Line.
How far into hip-hop does it go? You think it ends with Drake?
I don't think it ends with Drake. I'm not sure it gets to, you know, like Helta Skelta, but I'm not convinced that there's not a Nas song on there. You know, I'm not convinced there's not a Jay-Z song on there. Right. Like, you know, I think we also have to remember, like, how much listenership of mainstream hip-hop is casual. Like, it may not be someone who goes to a Jay show or goes to a whatever, a future show.
Rap is pop.
Yeah. And so it's like, I think that it's totally normal for these kids. It's just they would more likely go to a Mike Studd show. Like, if you look at the crowds that are on the Mike Studd reality show, you look at the crowds, I don't see necessarily those kids at the future Drake tour. But that doesn't mean there aren't, like, loads of white kids at the future Drake tour.
Which there are.
Yeah. It's just, like, I don't see those particular. You have to start, like, splitting the difference. Yes.
Now, what responsibility do these artists have to hip-hop history?
Well, see, this is the thing. And I think what's really striking to me is I've come up in an era where that is an important value and one that people adhere to. And it's been interesting because if you go back to, like, the late 90s and early 2000s, the first crisis of this was, like, the backpack rap scene, right? Like the indie rap kids, your sort of post-Raucous, your Def Jux guys, your Rhymesayers guys, Aesop Rock, Slug, who is of mixed racial background but sort of often pegged as a white rapper, that whole scene. And I think any of those guys would tell you that they considered themselves students. But it was weird because it was the first time for me as a fan that I ever went to a rap concert that was primarily white in the crowd.
Right.
You know, I remember going to, like, maybe it was like a nonfiction show or something. I was just like, oh my God, like, this is weird. It's like 90% white kids in the crowd. It's very strange. That was a novel thing back then. But I don't think any of those artists would have said, this is what our dream was. We always thought we'd be rapping for only white people, number one. And they would always consider themselves part of the tradition. And I think went out of their way to let you know where they felt like they fit in the tradition. You talk to LP and LP would be like, you know, the Bomb Squad production. Like, that's what I hear in my head. I think this generation of rappers, we're talking 10 to 15 years removed from those first moments of white artist, white crowd. I think they have come up in a universe where that's actually just a plausible thing. It's like, I can choose to make rap songs that'll put me on rap radio. This is where G-Eazy gets confusing a little bit. I can choose to make those songs, or I can just make songs that are about my experience and people will come out, and rap is so popular that there's enough people off here at the fringe that'll support my career. I don't know if Mike Studd wakes up in the morning and knows he's making that decision, but the fact that he even has that decision to make, that that's even an available choice to him, tells you a lot about what's happening in rap music right now.
So while Mike Studd doesn't interact really with
ideas about right
or race,
yeah,
outside of sharing a friend with Drake and
shout out to OB O'Ryan,
getting Rock Nation to come to his shows. You have someone like
Lil
Dicky.
A lot of free time on his hands,
a
by
lot
the way,
of free
to be on that tour.
Yeah, he's on a chunk of that tour.
Absolutely.
He's on the bus.
Absolutely.
He's
leisure. He's the leisure king.
But then you have someone like Lil Dicky, whose thing is, you know, a little bit comedy, a little bit rap, mm-hmm. but, you know, he wants to remind you he has bars too, mm-hmm. if you check the SoundCloud.
Here's the thing. Lil Dicky, probably the best technical rapper of anybody I talk about in this piece and really anybody in this world.
But he's also interacting
Sorry.
With mainstream black rappers. They're on this album. Now, what's up with that?
I don't have a better answer to that than that question.
His big hit features Rich Homie Quan
and Fetty. Lil Dicky is someone who I think doesn't take no for an answer. Like, he's extremely persistent. If you look at... A thing that I have done is not just watch the video for Save That Money, which is the song that you're referring to, but I've also watched the 20-minute behind-the-scenes making of that video.
A lot of bathrobes.
Yeah, but there's a whole extra thing where you see him really go and pleading his case. And here's a guy who lacks whatever gene that's like a self-awareness or like, I'm going to look silly gene. Like, he just doesn't have that.
What is Save That Money about?
It's about being... skinflint. It's about being cheap. It's about not spending money. It's basically thrift shop, but the thing with a thrift shop is if you look on paper, you can reasonably argue that thrift shop maybe isn't about hip. It's like about hip hop, but it's not really. It exists in a totally separate space. Save That Money is a rap song that's a real rap song
with real rappers.
That's about how silly rap excess is. And the thing that really troubled me about that video is you have Lil Dicky literally going door to door, sort of begging to be allowed to play the role of the fancy rapper, and yet making a song about how all of that is nonsense or about how it's not accessible to him.
So how does he get these
guys? He's also in an Arby's commercial. Have I remembered that correctly?
I don't even want
to sure he's in an Arby's commercial where he's like making it rain with dollar bills.
How does he get real rappers to interact with him? Maybe he's just really fun to hang out with? Because that's the Mac Miller thing, right?
Joe, I'm not a magician. I don't know. I'm not like the Amazing Kreskin. Like, I don't know all these, like, mysterious things. There are parts of the world that remain inaccessible to me. I don't know the answer to that, but I do know that, like, Snoop Dogg is on this record. Like, they're on his album. There are, like, plenty of people who you and I would be super shocked to see work with Lil Dicky. I think there's also part of Lil Dicky I do think is he has significant YouTube numbers, and I do think there's part of it where it's like you knock on someone's door, and it's like, hey, I want to do a record. 10 million people watch my last video. That's fine.
So do you think you are hand-wringing about this in a way that maybe the center of hip-hop is not?
No, I don't think so. Do you think that?
Well, it's your job.
That's my job. But no, I don't think so. I think that identifying this movement is basically identifying a subtext that a lot of people don't want to talk about. I mean, this is uncomfortable stuff. Like, no one who works in rap wants to be like, I'm racist against white people. And no white rapper wants to be like, I don't care about black acceptance. Like, no one wants to talk about this. So it's going to fall outside of the discourse of normal rap music interviews and rap musician interviews to kind of bring up these subjects. But I do think what we're seeing right now, this kind of sea change where you have the four rappers who I focus on in this piece, in my mind, have four very different fan bases and very different approaches. So the idea that all of them are kind of existing at the same time, in addition to a riffraff, in addition to, you know, weird juggalo rappers, in addition to country rappers, like there's all these other sub scenes and micro scenes that are happening. This is probably the first time really in rap music history that there's been this variety of white artists living in their own ecosystems. And that's, you know, stay woke.
Let's go out on a Lil Dicky song. Let's play Say That Money.
Woo!
We ain't about to go and spend money just to flex on them. We ain't really got a liar. I'm a type of motherfucker that'll check the check, do the math, I ain't never getting robbed. Those margaritas not going on my card. I ain't about to split a damn thing for convenience sake. I'm at the restaurant working now.
Thank you for listening to the New York Times podcast. You can read...
You know what I mean?
You can read John Caramonica on white rappers at nytimes.com/music or in your Sunday paper. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or your service of choice at nytimes.com/podcast. Listen to all the backlogs. We miss you, Ben Ratliff. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and we'll be back next week.